Namaste. So I am assuming the topic is nationalism, Sri Aurobindo's idea on nationalism, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Sri Aurobindo, the Rishi of Indian nationalism.
Right. Is the Rishi of Indian nationalism. So let's go back a little bit to the broader picture, then we narrow down to the whole thing. So if we really look at this world and the march of civilizations, as Sri Krishna says in the Gita, Lok Sangrahart, then we'll see that there are three layers at which history is being written. So what we see on the surface, like today, nowadays, we see many things happening on the surface, events and all kinds of changes, all kinds of, political and other shifts which are taking place. And we really can't make sense of it unless we go dip into the second layer. And the second layer is the psychological layer. At that layer, another something is happening in the world, which often goes unnoticed. It goes unnoticed because everybody is busy noting the events which are taking place on the surface. As I often say almost humorously that if a reporter, either BBC, CNN or even our Indian reporters had to report the Mahabharata war, what would they write about Krishna? Probably they'll write as a footnote that he was the cowherd's boy and a charioteer of Arjun. But that was not the truth. That was only on the surface. And yet Sri Krishna was conducting the whole Mahabharata war. Something very similar to what Sri Aurobindo was doing both during the freedom movement as well as during the Second World War. So the third layer, of which this second and the third are the real offsprings, is the spiritual layer. Now in the spiritual layer, we don't know what really is happening. Most of us are unaware. And yet, as Sri Aurobindo notes something very interesting, because this aphorism has a relevance to nationalism and the idea itself, that freedom, equality, fraternity was the cry of the French Revolution. And while people sprang up, you know, that's a long history, very fascinating history about the French Revolution. Sri Aurobindo himself was present there as one of the main guiding forces. And he says that an ascetic in the Himalayas, he dreamed of these truths. And you see, there is someone who dreams of these truths somewhere in some region, and there are people in the world who are dreaming of these things. And then slowly there is a shift taking place at the psychological layer of humanity, and then it starts spilling on the surface. So if we try to understand things based on the surface, we won't get to know. We have to understand what's happening in the psyche of people, and still deeper, how the revolutions take place deep within. There is a spiritual sowing. So with this background, we come to first Mother Earth, and how, just a quick review of how the evolution of mankind has taken place at the Homo sapiens erectus level. Otherwise, it's been a very long history. So there are different ways of looking at the earth, but when we really look at it in a certain way, just the right conditions for life, that's what scientists say. And if we go around in galaxies and many others, we are still not sure if there is any signal of life anywhere on Earth, apart from Earth. There must be, I'm sure. But that apart, the fact that the Earth is in certain ways a singular planet where life has blossomed. Now, what is really specific to Earth? The mother says it's a special formation. It's a kind of evolutionary laboratory. And we can also look at Earth, which is how our ancient scriptures have seen Earth, as a goddess. So always Prithvi is Mata. She is a goddess, and Akash is the Pita, the heavens. So when we say that heaven is the Pita, heaven in not in the sense of the Western world heaven, but the heights, the skies, and the Prithvi as Mata, then we are a double birth. So our body is formed by Mother Earth, and our souls belong to the higher realms. That's the basic idea, that with the coming together of two, and the purpose of human birth is essentially to bring these two poles together. That means the divine and the material, the spiritual and the material. So this is the background, and when we look at Earth as a mother, then where does a nation fit into it? So we can look at it as a human being, and when we look at a human being, then there are different parts and each part has its own place. You can't shift. Of course, people shift the parts. Some people think with their stomach and some with their knees, but that's a different story, metaphorically and perhaps psychologically true. But by and large, there are different layers and each nation represents some part of the totality called Mother Earth. That's how, you know, and if you really look at the entire geography, it's very fascinating that many nations, they don't have very distinct boundaries always, but there are very reasonably clear boundaries which demarcate them, as if that's how nature has planned. Like if you look at the Indian nation, for a long, long time, way back, it was described as Jambudvip, and we have a description that Uttar, when you go to the northern side, there's the Himalayas, and on the three sides there is the Dravida. The Dravida basically meant surrounded by water. It didn't mean Dravida as we understand today. So Dravida was Dravya. It comes from that root. So on three sides is surrounded by water, and on the northern side by the Himalayas. So that's how there are some natural formations which, if you look at France, so you'll see rivers certain side. There are other countries. If you look at Pakistan and India, there is no real border. I mean, if you take the run of Kutch and up in the Himalayas, then it's a continuous thing. But otherwise, much of Pakistan in India, there is no real border. It's a very artificially created country. And similarly, we look at Bangladesh. So there are, in fact, Russia and Ukraine. If you really look at Russia and Ukraine, unless you hit the river which divides the western and the eastern Ukraine, there is no real boundary. So why this is important to start with the nationalism, it starts with the formation of countries before we talk about nations. So it is the country which is the base. By country is meant the soil in which people or a group of humanity grows up. And then it goes through a certain kind of experience, common experience, collective experience. For example, I mean, people often speak in India of north, south, east, west divide. But if you really travel across, mother's grace that I have traveled to every state of India. And I can tell you that it's very, very similar, almost same. If you go to Manipur, you just wonder that you are in that kind of bhakti, that kind of love for Krishna. You go to the western part, you go to the northern, you go to the southern part, particularly southern Pondicherry where I am staying. And if you go even deep down south Kerala, your government may be whatever. Government may believe or not believe. That's not really relevant except for our temporary purposes. But you see the same culture. And if you go across the border to Punjab in Pakistan, you will again see a very shared kind of history. Now, religions try to blur it. That's okay. That's a different chapter we can discuss when it comes to. But the country is the first basis of nationalism. And Sri Aurobindo says that very clearly, that that's how it should be. And why country is the basis? Because there is a humanity which has sprung up and has a shared experience through which it passes through. There are many imprints in the collective psyche, many common issues, many challenges which have been common, and of course the cultural roots and even their beliefs, patterns, all this, even habits, they develop over a period of time. So now we come to then, okay, if country is the basis, so when was nationalism in the modern sense born? Of course, as I said, if we go back far past, we see that in India you already have the sense of country. So what really is nationalism? So nationalism is, earlier, before nation unit, there were countries. And countries were governed by kingdoms, were kingdoms. So kingdoms were governed by kings. And kings wanted empires. So there never was really a clear-cut nation unit. Because most, if you look at the age of empires, almost starting from when? Even before Ottoman Empire, then the Roman Empire, Alexander. It was the age when nature was trying. As I said, there is a deeper truth which is happening, throwing up the events. So nature was trying to unify the race or at least prepare them by mixing, meeting, all kinds of. For example, the British Empire took back from India not only Kohinoor but also the Gita. So in the bargain, the seed of the Gita traveled as far as ultimately the United States and you know how and in Europe and how people started taking interest. So this was nature's experiment. I mean, we have to look at it impersonally for a moment, not get emotionally involved, and look at it from that perspective. We'll say that nature was trying to create conditions, situations through wrestle, through embrace. You begin to understand the different units of mankind, begin to absorb certain things, begin to discard certain things. So all this had started long, long back. But then something happened in France, and that's where the French Revolution and Sri Aurobindo connection also comes in. That in France, we know that late 1700, the French Revolution took place. I'm not going into the background because there are many debatable, controversial issues about it. But at least one thing that got established through all the ups and downs. When you look at it from the surface, one would say that the revolution failed. Many people believe that the revolution failed because the king and the queen were killed, but ultimately it gave birth to Napoleon Bonaparte, who himself became, he's an emperor. So on one point of view, it may look like a failed revolution. And on the other point of view, this was a highly successful revolution because the idea not only did not die, it spread all over Europe. And it found its way to India. So in Indian constitution, if you read the first page, it's the same idea of the French Revolution. And I've been wondering where it came from, because I don't know how this idea got enshrined in the Indian constitution. On the first page preamble, you'll read about liberty, equality and fraternity. So the idea not only didn't die, it gave rise to democracy, took the power from the king into the hands of the people. And who are the people? Now, people are those who have a shared common experience and culture. That's how the nation unit was formed. The king arbitrarily went, invaded, raided, plundered, looted in his, you know, greed and ambition. But nation was a unit which started with, okay, look here, these people, they have a right to self-determination. They are going to govern. And that's how the nation unit started, modern nation units. And then the wave spread, because the moment we saw this happening in Europe and other places and India, it was already happening last almost 17th century, or rather 18th century, this wave, age of revolution started. And in India also it started, even before the mutiny. So we see that simultaneously, nature was trying to create the nation unit, almost delivering the nation unit out of empires. So what really is a nation unit? What is nature trying to do? You know, ultimately all mankind is one. That's how we say. So Sri Aurobindo describes this in one of his beautiful aphorisms. There are three steps of Vishnu. And these three steps are at unification of mankind. The first step is family. So what do we learn in a family? We learn sacrifice. It's only when, you know, a person who gets married and then has a child that one learns to sacrifice. This is the first law of sacrifice. So sacrifice is the governing truth of this universe. That's how Sri Krishna puts in the Gita that by sacrifice, by yajna, I have made this creation. And the first thing about sacrifice we learn is that we are not in this world as separate units. We are there as distinct units, which is different. We are all unique in that sense, but we are not separate. So this world is interconnected, there is an interdependence, and you know, there is the sense of sharing which comes with the spirit of sacrifice. So the first lesson of sacrifice is when family and then clan, tribe, all this nature was trying. But family is the stable unit, because that's where you first learn. And then from the family, we see the next stride of Vishnu, Sri Aurobindo speaks of, is the nation. So why? Because now what happens in nation? Now in a family, at least you are physically connected by birth. But in a nation, though you are physically connected, but not by the same parent, you are physically connected through the soil. There are many things. For example, when you go out abroad, I have very funny experiences also. Once I remember, you know, in Russia. So one of my friend who was there, he was an Indian, and I mean Indian origin, but now Russian. And I said, you know, you have such long roads, drives, and I feel like, you know, going to the washroom, and do you have a petrol pump somewhere near? He said, no, don't worry, we are Indians and we have our own way. Now I was very surprised that this is a typical Indian habit, that they it's not a good habit. By the way, of course, Russia is like vast, and you have lands, stretches of land where there is nothing, you don't see anything. But they are typically Indian ways of looking at life, even jokes and even sensibilities, which are typically Indian. Similarly, they are typical French, typically British humor. If you read P.G. Woodhouse, you see it. It's a typically British humor. A little gentlemanly, a little summer, but classic. It's like a wit. So one has to understand that each nation has its own interesting ethos through which it evolves. If you talk to a Pakistani Indian, very typical, similar kind of humor, similar kind of ethos. So therefore, when artificially one creates boundaries, this is one of the problems that the Britishers did. That they didn't understand all this about nation's soul, no? So they created very artificial boundaries. They just decided, okay, this is the line. It doesn't work like that. Say, you know, it has created so much problem. Like between India and China, there is a natural barrier. But if you start spilling inside, going other side, there is a problem. Now you see again, if you look at China and Tibet, just to see the natural boundaries. Now Tibet is suddenly, you see, from the mainland China, it's at a height on the Himalayan peak. It's regarded as the roof of the world. So there is a very clear, distinct demarcation. So people develop in a certain way. And one cannot, suddenly, when we try to somehow mix and match and create a hodgepodge, it creates, almost opens doors to perennial conflict for a long, long time. Because that's not how they are like brothers, and they will fight because they belong to the same ultimately origin, and each is like a brother claiming his house, the full house. So this is how we have to understand that a nation unit is the experiment of nature to first teach us how to live together. Still going on, long way. Though we have different religions, we may have different castes, different jati, varna, language, customs, even for that matter. But we have to learn to live together, because before we talk about world unity, if we cannot create a sense, spirit of unity even within the within a certain geographical region which has such shared common, many things in common, then forget about world unity is a very big word. So nation unity is the experiment which is going on right now. And one cannot create a nation by obliterating entire exclusive, we can't, people may be exclusive in their beliefs. And yet in a nation, you have to learn, it's a challenge to live together. And it's a very big challenge because it requires a great change of human consciousness already. So nation unit is still in the formation. Hardly any country we can say that, has a very clear-cut nation unit. India, with all its experience in the background. Even now it's struggling to have a clear nation unit where different people can come together and live together, because there are challenges imposed by different forces. We'll not go into that. But that's what a nation is. Its birth in modern times is out of the French Revolution. And in many ways, there is a great truth inside it. And the truth is that ultimately, if we go back to the original plan of, universe or creation, so one way of spiritually looking at it is Maya. Obviously, it is like cutting the knot, not opening it. It's like you leave the question unanswered by saying there is actually no question. So the question is an illusion of your mind. So it doesn't really solve the problem that we experience in life every day. The other conception is Leela. So in the Leela, it's an unfolding of God. And in English, Shobhinda would use the word that this earth is a field for the manifestation of the divine. In fact, the material universe. And in this manifestation, each nation has to bring its own unique strength. So now we can look at this each nation as a part. Sometime when I used to see the map of the world, and I would see America and Russia. So it's amazing. If you look at it from one side, they are on two different parts of the world. No? But if you go the other side, it's like almost together they are embracing the world. They are just going to touch, Alaska, if you get it. So it's amazing that they are like two arms, and literally like two poles, two strong, quite strong, both of them. So, like two arms, bhuja. Now, sometime when you look at India, so it's very interesting that Shobindo picturized India as the now, okay, before I come to India, what does India represent? Each nation is representing something or the other. Like if you look at Europe, so you will see a kind of intellectual renaissance took place in Europe, of which French and Greece in different points of time. So when it comes to the intellect, you will see Europe, you know, bringing out intellectual ideas. But if you go to the heart and the psychic being, soul, you will see India always spearheading. That's how nation units are. Each must bring its own strength. And then when you come to India, when you look at the map of India, it will look like a goddess with almost a trident in hand and her feet is dipping into the waters. That's how it's described in Kalidas, I think it's Raghuvansham I think it's the lineage of Raghu. But interesting part is, Shurvindu spoke of the guardian deity of India as Durga, one of the forms of Durga. And if you really look at the image of India as Durga, what do you find at the base? We see what we call as Sri Lanka. But Sri Lanka, they are Sinhalese people. Their emblem on the flag is a lion. Is it just a chance or coincidence? Where are lions found in Sri Lanka? It's just strange if you look at. So there is a kind of deeper truth trying to manifest, which we are not able to see. So a lot of, but ultimately that will get fulfilled, but unfortunately through a lot of struggle. So in India, how the unit India was created long back before the nation called India would be recognized, it was by the ancient fable of Sati. See, Mahadev, and we know the parable of Sati. So I'll probably recount it only in quickly, that again it's a land which has been created by sacrifice. So the divine mother as Sati sacrifices herself because Shiva is not welcome. So right from beginning it is known that, well, you may have any amount of rules and regulation in the society, but you have to have scope for spiritual freedom. Shiva represents that. He doesn't follow any rule, regulations. He is his own truth. So, Daksha Prajapati doesn't want Shiva. He wants society according to his rules. But Shiva, he will not allow Shiva to enter. Like modern secularists, that everything is allowed, but God has to be away from the mainstream. So, that's exactly what Daksha tried. That God has to be away from the mainstream. You can privately follow Shiva, but he will not be given the portion of the yajna. So we see what happens after that. We know the event. So I'll just Shobindu recount this as parable of Mahadev and Sati. Sati plunges into the fire. She will be reborn as Parvati, as the Shalputri, Shalbala, the daughter of the mountains. That means material level. So from the material plane, the evolution will start through the Navdurga, since it's the festival of Durga. All the planes are described, you know, Shalputri, Brahmacharini, all of them. There's a whole talk that I gave once on this thing. So now when we look at the parables of Sati, then Shiva is moving around the four quarters, and Lord Vishnu is the great preserver. So he cuts the body into different parts, and in each part the body falls. Now it's very, some part of the body falls. Now it's very interesting that though Shiva is moving all around the quarters, he's not confined to India, but the parts of the Sati fall on almost the form a cultural boundary of India. You see, it's very interesting. So India is a very special occult formation where, you know, it's a land where things like sacrifice, things like tapasya, it's the land of tapasya, land of sacrifice, land of Shiva, land of Durga. That's how India is. Now, whatever other countries are, that's why we see that dharma refuses to die. So anyway, this is the background. So every nation has its unique place. And so independence of a nation is important for it to play its role in the totality. And that's why when Sri Aurobindo spoke about Swaraj, he combined it with the idea of independence. The word independence is first time used by Sri Aurobindo, because Swaraj can mean that, well, basically we are the ones who are dominating. But you people can govern yourself. So Swaraj could mean that. So Sri Aurobindo even used the word Purna Swaraj, which basically implied independence. He is the first one who has used the word Purna Swaraj. Subsequently, this was picked up. Of course, Tilak is along with him. But if you go back to the writings, so his nationalistic ideas of Purna Swaraj included not just independence, that freedom to do whatever you want to do, but also political independence. Because unless a nation is politically independent, it cannot be itself. So that's how we see Sri Aurobindo starting this whole movement of nationalism, where he started looking at nation as a living goddess. And there is a beautiful story, so many anecdotes, but one of them was when somebody in his class in Baroda asked Sri Aurobindo that, well, what do you see in India? I mean, do you really see her as a living goddess? Because that's what he said. He said, do you think that I am a materialist fool who will talk about dying for a piece of land? So the land's value is not because it is only a piece of land. The land's value is because this is a Yajnavedi. So each land has its own unique meaning. So it's not just a dead piece of land. Even at a human level we can understand. In India it has always been known. For example, you go to a temple, it's a piece of land. Some people may say you go to the ashram. In ashram there is some people like to say it is the tomb of Sri Aurobindo. So I have to tell them that look, it's not the tomb of Sri Aurobindo. It is the Tirtha Sthal, because it's the Yajnavedi and it is the Tapostali of Sri Aurobindo. So we understand that this is a land charged by the tapasya of Sri Aurobindo and the mother. See the difference between a purely materialistic vision that, you know, as some people keep saying, what is India? There is no country. It's just a union of state. This is a very absurd idea. That means we are again dismembering a profound truth. It's not, it may be a materialist way of looking at it. Like many communist ideologies don't believe in anything like a nation at all. They believe in joining the world in a uniform way by ideologies. So similarly we see in Islam, it doesn't believe in the country unit. Now this is dangerous because second step of Vishnu is nation. Unless humanity passes through this stage, gets purified, develops malleability, develops all that is necessary for world unity, it cannot take the next step. And each time it takes the next step, it's not an annulment of the first. So the next step is going to be internationalism. We can see that rumbling whispers. But just as belonging to a nation does not mean that I don't belong to a family. You're part of a family, but the larger unit is the nation. And the idea of the nation is where you learn that I, just as in a family, I learn to subordinate my own interest for the sake of the family, and just as I learn to subordinate the interest of the family for the sake of the tribe and clan, I mean ancient times, no more now. Similarly, I have to learn to subordinate the interest of my own family, clan, tribe or jati or whatever for the interest of the nation. Because why? Because these are still uniform things, but whereas the first experiment of unity and diversity will be in a nation. So to demand separation of states based on simply because of language difference is again to go turn the clock backward, because this grand experiment is going on for unity and diversity. And that was the great problem, you see. And whenever human beings have tried to do it, it has failed. See what happened with Islam. So Islam tried to create things on a basis of uniformity, brotherhood of Islam. They spoke of brotherhood, but ultimately it was brotherhood of the believers. And then they crossed through all the so-called natural boundaries. What happened? Now there is an infighting, because you cannot do it. Its nature will not allow. You create a nation based on or demand statehood for a separate countryhood for a place just because you have a similar language, you will fight and break into tribes. This exactly the clock will work backward. Because power thirsty, power hungry people, they will start breaking it into small units. So we must understand the dangers, and they are not dangers just to a unit called India. It's a collective experiment which is taking place. Towards what end? Not nation is not the last word. But towards the much greater end of a world unity, but on the basis of unity in diversity. Not a unit where nation will be blurred. So that's where it's not like formation of empires. So still people have this old idea that there'll be a world state governed by, some chosen ones. No, it's dangerous. Because the moment you have a world state, once again imperialism will come through the back door. You cannot do that. You have to allow self-governance, right to self-rule. All this Sri Aurobindo has very beautifully explained. And yet humanity has to come together, each nation bringing its own strength. France, its subtlety of intellect. India, its soul. It's the most important part. Sri Aurobindo says that in this Chatur Yoga at least, he says for each kalpa, for each Chatur Yoga, God chooses a particular country to be at the center stage of the evolutionary process. And he says in this Chatur Yoga at least, it is India. So now from there we understand that what was Sri Aurobindo's idea of nationalism. So Sri Aurobindo used the word, it is a spiritual religion. It's a spiritual nationalism. He said nationalism is a cult. It's a religion. It is spirituality. So what does he mean by that? He means that we do not love the nation only for the sake of, we are born here. That's okay. But we love the nation, we are ready to die and sacrifice ourselves for the nation simply because the nation itself is required for the larger good of the world. So his nationalism was not simply loving India as a piece of land. So we have this idea of nationalism where, now I'm not touching upon things like protectionism and all that, because protectionism had a place at some point of time. It still has a certain place if there is an economic warfare as is going on today. But otherwise, protectionism, that is Swadeshi, boycott. Swadeshi is important because otherwise nations run the risk of becoming dependent again. Sri Aurobindo foresaw it. So he spoke of Swadeshi. But it doesn't mean that everything, every country will produce. That's not really possible. They have to share with each other. If you try to block that, it's like turning a flowing river into a pond, and a pond dries up. So it's very dangerous whatever a country is doing, trying to block all the inflow, thinking that your own people will grow up. That's not the way. You have to encourage self-determinism. That's fine, but Swadeshi, it's a nice thing. Again, boycott doesn't have meaning in today's time because there is such a interdependence in today. But Sri Aurobindo was the first one who used the word Swaraj, Swadeshi, boycott, and he used one more word to foster the national ideal, which now we are beginning to revive, and that word was national education. So when he used the word national education that time, people wondered. Because education is, after all, everywhere it's the same thing. After all, education is all science, technology. Where is the difference of national education? I'll give you one example of what is the difference of national education. So we have dolls. So same technology, science in creating a Barbie doll, isn't it? The same technology and science in creating a little idol of Krishna. And you can even, I have seen a very beautiful idol of Krishna where the image was of Nand Baba taking Krishna on his head in a soup. And Yamuna is, so it was like robotically, those simple mechanisms where you charge it and then it unwinds like a clockwork. So every time you charge it, then they will show the next step will be that Krishna, the Yamuna is heaving and Krishna's feet is touching and then it goes down. Now it's the same science and technology. So what difference does it make? One conveys the idea of a zero figure. See, Barbie dolls have done so much damage to I mean, as a psychiatrist, I see anorexia nervosa entering India. And I always say it's the Barbie doll bringing anorexia nervosa. We didn't know it. When I was studying medicine psychiatry, we were told it's uniquely British or England, those areas you find anorexia nervosa, because zero figure and all that. Now it has come to India. How did it come to India? It came to India because every time science gave a gift, technology is there. I'm talking of the elementary technology. You gave a Barbie doll. And you gave a Barbie doll, and children started developing this idea that this is beautiful. Now I'm giving one example. We can take another example at the other extreme level. Look at, you know, we are going to explore it. It may look right now and very strange, but in India we have Vimana Shastra, which has been written by Bharadwaj Rishi. And he describes all kinds of different Vimanas, and those even by mantra, which can move by mantra. And these are the best kind. But these require a very high degree of purity in the pilot. Now you see, technology is going to what level? And we are going to discover, because very soon we'll have a breakthrough, maybe 10 years, 20 years, thought-driven machines. The moment you have thought-driven machine, the step of mantra, moving machines, is not going to be very far. But see how we were dealing with the same technology in a very different way. So there should be this idea that there is nothing like national education. Education is all same. Besides, education is not only about science, it's also about art. If you look at the art in Europe, and I'm using Europe very loosely, and my European friends will excuse me, but let's say German art is very different from French art. And we know Napoleon Bonaparte, when he went, what was the place I'm forgetting, somewhere near Turkey. And he is a very strange king or emperor, that he would not steal. He was one person who would not care about plundering any country which he conquered. But there he stole the art statues because he loved them and brought them all the way to France. So you see, that art is very different when you take Indian art. It's a very different kind of art. When we go to the development of a human being, which is the most important thing, we have nothing in any education anywhere in the world, except in India. So how did in India, we spoke about man-making or divine man-making. It was part of the education. The entire Gurukul, with its stress on concentration, discipline, brahmacharya, which nowadays we despise. It's not just about handling mobiles and, you know, reading all the equations, but it was about becoming a human being, worthy of being called a human. Now, I don't see anywhere in the world now people bring in value-added in education, as if it's something to be added as an aside. In many places, not yet there. But in India, it's not just value-added education. Value is the base, dharma. So you see, there is something known as national education. National education is not just about the curriculum in Hindi or Sanskrit. That's not what it means. It's not just incorporating certain ancient texts. That's okay. But the crux of national education is that who are we as Indians? Now here Sri Aurobindo brings in that, you know, this grand experiment took place in certain places, and then he says very proudly that we are Aryans. And this word was, before Sri Aurobindo has explained its meaning, this word is picked up by Hitler and misused it, just like he picked up swastika. But when we look at this idea that who are we as Aryans, now this is connected with nationalism. And it's important to debunk the Aryan Dravidian theory, not only because it's false, but because it gives a new perspective to who we are. So our national identity is not just a passport. It's there in our genes, it's there in our blood, it flows in our veins, it's settled in our bones, it's there in the food, the air we breathe. And what is that? It speaks of that high spiritual manhood of man. That's what we see. Who was the Aryan? Aryan is a psychological type. And he is the symbol of what spiritual manhood would be. Aryan is not just a human being striving, you know, job. He's striving for job, success, career, money. All that is okay. That's a side dish. That's okay. That has its place. But the Aryan is one who fights for what is true, what is right, what is beautiful, not only outside but inside. An Aryan is somebody who sows the field, the soil of his own nature, and to bring out the bounty of God's seeds which are inside. So that way, when we look at it, and that's why Shubhendu used the word Arya for all the series that he was, his writings from 1914 to 1920. And the mother at one place says, you know, I wish that every nation would emulate this high ideal. Not this high ideal, must discover its own high ideal. So I'm not sure if in France they are, I really don't know, so I can't say, whether they are teaching the ideal of, you know, liberty, equality and fraternity and what it means. For example, fraternity is just not possible arbitrarily. It's only possible if you discover the spiritual self. Any other basis of fraternity is bound to fail. So this is the whole idea of national education, that it helps to shape the national character. It creates a national mold, a national type. And those of us who have grown up with these stories know very well that, you know, for us, whatever our defects may be, plenty. But when you asked, Rama is somebody we look upon. Arjun is somebody we look upon. That's what we want to be. Sita is somebody we look upon. She is for us the symbol of the feminine strength. That even if she is discarded, abandoned, still she doesn't resort to court cases. She doesn't resort to, marrying somebody or running away with somebody. She doesn't do any of these things. She resorts to her own strength. And she says, I need nobody. I mean, the life of Sita is so remarkably the strong feminine character. One of the strongest. And we paint her as Abla. See, so many things, if one begins to say that how India created a nation, and so national education is so important. And Sri Aurobindo says, apart from these four, each of these is a subject for discussion, especially national education, because we are still thinking of syllabus. We are still thinking of putting in this, and you need courage. For example, Ramayana and the Mahabharata and the Gita should be part of national education in India. Simply because they are common shared culture. It doesn't matter. I may be a Muslim or Christian or anybody, but my cultural roots are with the Ramayana. What have they done in Indonesia? See, one example of how, when you keep the culture intact, what happens. So Indonesia is the country with maximum percentage of Muslims. I think 95%, if I'm not mistaken. And Indonesia's past is so typically Indian. They even today, and they don't shy away from it. They even today, they have Ramayana plays, and you know, they have Ganeshas, and they celebrate the fact that they were Indians. They were Hindus. So they celebrate that our culture, common culture, shared values that have sprung up. And then we adopted Islam at some point of time. Now the latest thing is, of course, we all know that because the... Anyway, that's a long history why they could not reconvert back. Many of them wanted to, but the king's daughter, I believe she adopted Hinduism, and now the king himself, the present prime minister. So if you look at UNGA recent speech, I'm speaking of just 2 days back, see how a common culture makes a difference. So there were Muslim countries in which, there was a meeting of Muslim countries, not the UNGA, but Muslim countries in which our Mr. Loudspeaker was also there. Okay. So what else to say? Now, very interesting that all the Muslim countries spoke of this or that, but one Muslim country, the only Muslim countries, spoke in favor of Israel. Which Muslim country? Indonesia. And the Prime Minister says something very interesting. He says, well, he started his speech with Om Shanti. He ends up with Om Shanti Shanti Namo Buddhaya. Now these things go undocumented. I mean, it just passingly got documented. Probably they just caught it by, you know, they have to complete for the sake of completion. But what does it indicate? It indicates that they, if you remain with your roots, even if you adopt any religion, there is no problem because you will get it right. So people often speak about the Hindu-Muslim problem in India. This is because it has been created artificially by making the Muslims disconnect with the land of origin and owe allegiance to the land of Arabia. If a Muslim in India always understood that, well, our background is Rama and Krishna, and by religion I am a Muslim because I believe in that, there is no problem. He would never become fundamentalist of this kind. But he is almost like, even in Arab they don't have, because that's a natural religion of the place. Because they don't have this conflict inside. But here you want to prove that you are a greater, greater mountain than anybody else. So through an education, it's only when people reconnect with the roots. And this would be the solution to the problem in Pakistan also. There was a, you know, once some Muslims there were really trying to revive this, reconnect with the Indus Valley civilization and the Vedas, because they said this is our past. And even I was invited to, you know, that conference. Unfortunately, the lady who was inviting, she died mysteriously. Of course, they say that something happened. 29-year-old girl. I mean, it was a very personal loss, like a real sister she was. And, you know, she was a Muslim. But she said, my roots are Vedic. She loved reading the Vedas, enjoyed. So there is no conflict. There is something which is our shared culture. And so we should be courageous. This is an artificial divide created. A colonial mentality where, you know, you can't teach Ramayana and Mahabharata because it'll hurt Muslim sentiments. It's not about religion. It's the culture people must know. And when they know the culture, they connect much deeply with the soil. Right now, they're disconnected. In the madrasas, they are disconnected completely. In Pakistan, history doesn't start before. They don't teach any of the Indus Valley civilization, nothing. So when you do that, now what happens in Europe? You have to teach about, you know, Greece, what ancient Greece was. So there is a need of a national education, and there are many facets to it. It's a vast subject, just to touch it. And then Sri Aurobindo says, but even if you have all these four things, still something will be missing unless you turn nationalism into a religion. What is he meant by religion? Not as a belief system. He says that you have to regard your country, the nation, as God. So what is the difference? He says, when you live for her, sacrifice for her, you're not sacrificing for a group of people, for a constitution, for... Sometimes people say that, you know, soldiers sacrifice so that we can rest peacefully. This is not true. They sacrifice for something much greater. I would say by saying this, we are diminishing. Go to Ladakh and go to that place where, Sikkim. Even Ladakh, you go to the outpost where, you know, the highest post. You will see all through the lines of the Gita, places on the footsteps that, you know, they are not dying for some foolish people, selfish people living in mainland. Of course, that's their job. But when a soldier is, who can sacrifice fully his life? Not if he's thinking that, okay, if I sacrifice, somebody will sleep peacefully in home. No. He will sacrifice if he thinks that this is a living mother. And that's why when you look at many of their slogans, that war cry chants, you know, Indian battalions have very interesting chants. I don't know about the other places, but these chants have a very, you know, Har Har Mahadev, Jai Ma Durga, you know, they're chants. And they inspire the enthused because it connects with our own springs of strength. So these soldiers, so when we regard the country as mother, then it infuses the spirit of nationalism in the true sense. So we have on one side patriotism. A patriot will also die for the country. It's a sattvic impulse. You know, he feels that, well. But nationalism is something important because it brings the element of pride. Sri Aurobindo says, he says that nationalism is rajasic, but it's needed. The sense of pride. That, you know, we are, many things you will not do simply because You know, when you go out, when you carry yourself, conduct yourself, many of us travel abroad, we remember that, you know, whatever we do, people will notice it, as here is a person coming from a country, and I must say many of our Indian brothers do very well when they go out. For example, I know some of the American friends, and when they went for the first time, their neighbors asked them, "Oh, you come from the land of Buddha, the land of Krishna," and it's the very fact you are coming from such a land, they have a natural respect for you. So we have to understand that, you know, nation unit is not just a piece of land. It's a Yajnavedi. And therefore, Sri Aurobindo's spiritual nationalism is that we should treat it as we would worship God. And he says that unless you are ready to die and give everything for the sake of the mother who comes to us in the form of the nation, Janani Janma Bhumi, Durga, yes, or mother, simply Matra Bhumi, till then you cannot build the nation. This is what Sri Aurobindo awakened in the Indian people, and he so beautifully closed it with Durga's throat. We all know that his last document, where through Durga's throat he awakened the whole soul of a nation. So this is the background. These are the key ideas. This was subject, but I would like, if there are questions, so I'll just read just a little bit, some portions which Sri Aurobindo speaks of. Very powerful passages. And then he says, you know, this is very important, because sometimes, yeah, just I'll take 5-7 minutes more. Some people, you know, think that individuals are important. This is dangerous. This can be very dangerous. Napoleon, Sri Aurobindo says, the arm of God striving through Europe. Now, what happened to Napoleon? Why did he meet his nemesis? Obviously, the Rakshasa awoke power. He had lust for power. That's okay. That doesn't matter. But the day he thought that he is France and France is Napoleon, he was finished. We should be very careful, because in India we have a hero worship. All that is okay, fine, fantastic. But we should know that a nation is far greater than any individual. It's the God himself. So when you go to a temple, God is God, priest is priest. Priest will change, but God does not change. So there he says, there is only one force, and for that force, I am not necessary. Sri Aurobindo is saying that. You are not necessary. He is not necessary. Neither myself nor another, nor Bipin Chandrapal, nor all these workers who have gone to prison. None of them is necessary. Let them be thrown as so much waste substance. The country will not suffer. God is doing everything. Look at the spirit in which Sri Aurobindo was in the freedom struggle. If we can get 1% of that. We are not doing anything. What he bids us suffer, we suffer, because the suffering is necessary to give others strength. When he throws us away, he does so because we are no longer required. If things become worse, we shall have not only to go to jail, but give up our lives. And if those who seem to stand in front or to be absolutely indispensable are called upon to throw their bodies away, we shall then know that that also is wanted, that this is a work that God has asked us to do, and that in the place of those who are thrown away, God will bring many more. He himself is behind us. He himself is the worker and the work. He is immortal in the hearts of the people. Faith then is what we have. See, this is so different from the later ideas of Gandhiji, which were more about personal ideas and, you know, picking up something. This is about worshipping God. For, you know, it's about karma yoga. Truly in India, if somebody wants the regeneration, one has to be karma yogin. So through the worship of the nation, through the nation, one has to. And that's where sacrifice comes. So he speaks about faith, he speaks about self-denial, he speaks about courage, and he speaks about courage is then a necessity, courage is natural, and courage is inevitable. If you rely upon other forces, supposing that you are a nationalist in the European sense, meaning in a purely materialistic sense, that is to say, if you want to replace the dominion of the foreigner by the dominion of somebody else, it is a purely material change. Look how true it is. Simply by passing on the government to the Indians by birth, you don't do justice. It is not that you feel for the 300 million. So that is how he goes on. And I would invite everybody to read these things from Bengali writings. So the last sentence. If you have, then call yourself nationalist. Have you realized what nationalism is? Have you realized that it is a religion that you are embracing? If you have, then call yourself nationalist. And when you have called yourself nationalist, then try to live your nationalism. Try to realize the strength within you. Try to bring it forward so that everything you do, maybe not your own doing, but the doing of that truth within you. Try so that every hour that you live shall be enlightened by that presence, that every thought of yours shall be inspired from that one fountain of inspiration, that every faculty should be charged with that. So this is the nationalism that Sri Aurobindo wants us to live. And I am sure he has put in all the force in this land, all, even though he moved away. He said that I have done whatever was needed. So I am sure that India of the ages, as he said, cannot die. Because India is needed not just for Indians. The last thought. India is needed for the good of the world. So it's not an egoistic nationalism that I am an Indian, I'll naturally think of India. If it is only about India I am thinking, then I'll end up becoming like a pond. But I have to see India in the context of the world. There is something India has to give to the world, and for that India must rise, not just materially, not just economically, not just militarily, not just industrially, but most important spiritually. And not the spirituality of the world-shunning ascetic. We have had enough of it. But the spirituality of the future, not the India of Sanatan Dharma, which suns the world as illusion, but the Sanatan Dharma of original Sanatan Dharma of Sri Krishna, Bhishma, Rama, which looks at the world as the manifestation of God, where every Indian does his own to make India not just great for her own sake, but as a living embodiment of a divine truth and for the good of the world. So this is the invitation to Sri Aurobindo's idea of nationalism. Many more things, but time is limited, so I am holding here.
Thanks a lot, Arjun, for your If you have 2 minutes, if you can talk about the madnesses, three madnesses of Sri Aurobindo.
Okay, fine. The three madnesses of Sri Aurobindo. Yeah. So, yes. Okay, so the three madnesses of Sri Aurobindo has a certain context. So, context is that it is part of a private letter that he wrote to his wife. And obviously, there was no intention of making the letter public. But, British government made it public mainly because it wanted to prosecute him. Otherwise, it's a personal letter. And in that letter, Sri Aurobindo writes about that to his wife, that will you come along with me? Actually, what is the role of a husband and wife? So, wife is the Sahadharmini. She's not just, again, we have that original Indian conception of what wife is. She's not just an adorable princess and, you know, darling, all that is okay, fine. She's not, certainly not a pleasure object. Certainly not. She's not just somebody with whom you share your property, and certainly she's not a legal contract in India or a social construct. In India, wife is the Sahadharmini. So she is the one who walks along with the man, supporting the dharma and vice versa. So in that context, he writes to his wife, because obviously Sri Aurobindo he was known as Tyagarajan by his, many of his friends and co-patriots at that point of time. They would call him almost half human. Oh, Tyagarajan has come. He had not renounced anything outwardly. But his life was the life of a brahmachari. So that's how Shobindo was referred to. So his wife naturally would have suffered because he was much more, he was generous to a default, and many of the high qualities, compassionate, and you know, all, he was not the typical domestic family man. He himself said that, you know. So as a result, she would, you know, probably seek more attention. He would give, he would write very sweet letters. In one of his letters, he says, "My sweet beloved." So very beautiful letters. And there he writes that, you know, "I have not just one family, but the whole nation is my family and they are knocking at my doors. I know I have the strength to raise this nation." Who would write this? And then he speaks about the three madnesses. The first nation is that, you know, first madness is that he says that "I don't regard India just as a piece of land. She is a living mother. She is a goddess and I worship her." And the second he says that all who are there, and there he says that "I have the strength to raise them, these people, and I must give myself to that cause." And the third, it's the whole exact content you will find in Rishabh Chand's biography, very beautiful biography, the Shobindo during this period, Shobindo, his life unique, those who want to read it in great detail. And then the third he says is a madness that has seized me recently. And what is that madness? "I want to see God." So all of them, now you see, they are not cancelling each other. He is not running to Himalaya in his pursuit of God. They are going together. So that's what we see, that even when Shobindo went to Pondicherry, he continued to take interest in the affairs of India and the world. People didn't realize it, understand it, intervened about India when he was asked that, "What, I hope you are still engaged doing something about India's freedom." He says, "All that is already settled, 1931. I am working for what India will do with her freedom. Bolshevism, Gunda Raj, things look ominous." So he had already foreseen all that, but now from a higher poise. So his spiritual thought was not world shunning, but acting upon the world with a greater puza, with a greater knowledge. You know, that's what Karma Yoga of the Gita is. So like a real true Karma Yogin or integral yogin or whatever you want to put it, he wanted us to become real yogins, not just having an idea in the head. So this is how he spoke of the three madnesses to his wife. And then he closes in a very touching way, "Will you come with me?" Because in India, the wife is regarded as the Shakti of the husband. And he says, "If you come with me, you will get all the strength." And he says that you may say that, "What do I know? What can I do?" Because when you compare with Sri Aurobindo, anybody would feel, you know, intimidated. Though he is so full of compassion, but even now people feel intimidated. But when you read about his life, such a gentleman to a default. So compassionate, embodiment of sweetness. But then when you look at his intellect, it can be very, "Oh my God." So look at his wife coming from a Brahmo background in a typical Bengali family, not really, you know, seen much. And Sri Aurobindo, so obviously she must be feeling maybe much inferior. And that's where you see Sri Aurobindo's love. From what height that love is flowing? Like Ganges from the heart of Himalaya. And then he tells her, "Will you come with me? Will you be my Shakti?" That's how he asked her. And of course, we don't have the reply. And surely she, whatever she replied, she was not destined to be. And she left her body in 1918. Now, this madness has another aspect to it. Because here in Pondicherry region, somewhere in the early 1900 early 1900, late 1800. So there was a yogi called Nagai Japta. So he had his disciples, and his disciples went to him when he was leaving his body. And they asked him that, "Whom will we go for guidance?" His disciples included Srinivas Iyer and Parthasarathi and one more. So the yogi told them that, "Well, I am going, but there will be a yogi coming here soon, seeking refuge in this land. And he will be known by three signs. And he will be the one who will guide you." So they became his disciples, as we know. And then later on, you know, this story can be presented in a very Christ-like format. the three signs. And Shobhinda was asked about it and he confirmed, yes, he spoke about the three signs he spoke about were the three madnesses. So the first madness is about the nation, and the second was about, in fact, we can say humanity, the whole human race. And both of them are culminating or finding their grand culmination in the divine manifestation upon world. And that's what Sri Aurobindo upgraded his idea, that not just to, emancipation of humanity, but to fulfill God's will upon earth, to fulfill God's will in the nation, to fulfill God's will in the individual. So this became his refrain subsequently. So these are the three madnesses.
In fact, a few days before, I was reading the Uttarpara speech, wherein in the last he says that I have come to give you the message of the eternal religion.
Yes, yes.
Or this will be the future. India is not rising for herself, but she will rise for the world.
Yes. And very practically, one can see, actually, I have often discussed this with friends, that tell me what idea. I am now talking of idea. For us, Sanatan Dharma is something much too profound. But which idea today is needed to save the world? So you have seen, experimented with exclusive religions, and we know where they land up. I don't need to name them. This is an experiment exclusive religions have done. They cannot, because they can create unity within the believers. There is nothing like, even within them, even among the believers, you have those shades and there is fight. You cannot create unity on that basis. So mankind is going to discard that religion for sure. It's just a question of time. Which ideology you can create unity? Can you create unity on the basis of communism, socialism? No. We know how, if you go back to the origin of the communist idea, it's very interesting. But when you go to the implementation, Lenin, all these people, they were so intolerant. And who was that fellow I'm forgetting? Who?
Stalin.
Stalin, yes. So he would say that, if you disagree with the idea, you have no right to live. Actually, it went on to that extent, and we know what happened, because we tried to create unity and equality by flattening diversity. We cannot we have not been able to even look into it, though modern liberal thought tries to do it, and we know what mess it has landed itself into. So the only basis, and fraternity most importantly. So the only idea which can today really save the world, because we need some kind of a framework, it is Sanatana Dharma. Because unity in diversity, equality, fraternity are all embedded within it. Ekam Sad Vipra Bahudha Vadanti, and many other phrases I could go on. So today, knowingly, unknowingly, and ultimately, as I said, what is happening in the deep spiritual core will come up. So now we see the word Sanatana Dharma has caught the mind and imagination of many Indians and even in the world. So many things which an average person believes in America, despite whatever the political establishment may be, is very much like the Sanatana Dharma thought. So belief in rebirth, belief in that not a God who is punishing and busy rewarding, eternal damnation, they don't believe in it. So the world is shifting, and Sanatana Dharma is not only the religion of the past, but the religion of the future. But it's not religion in the way it is understood. Dharma, the law of life, the divine law, not as divine law given to an individual written on a hard tablet, but as the divine law which is expressing itself in the flower, in the tiger, in the rivers, in the mountains, in the child, in the sage, in the everyone. So that's the divine law which is moves on a very vast landscape and spontaneously creates harmony, because it's not a rigid, narrow, sectarian, dogmatic, fixed structure. So that's why Sanatana Dharma is the future. And Sri Aurobindo very much saw it as such, and he wanted India to be the not just the guardian, it has always been the guardian, but the flag bearer of Sanatana Dharma. And in its highest, deepest sense, it's coming up. One can see that. At least, the fact that the mind is engaging in that is a very good sign. Whatever the fault lines may be, they'll drop off. Yeah.
And the interesting part was that he talked about all this more than 100 years before.
Yes. Yeah.
What is happening today?
I'll tell you, if you read a writing in Karma Yoga, which is in 1907. So I read it one day deliberately, and I said, can you tell me when Sri Aurobindo wrote this? And it starts with, a new and young India is rising in the eyes of the world. So I said, can you say when he wrote this? So people, I said, if you don't know the birth line dates of Sri Aurobindo, you won't believe it. Just as in 1950 or 49, he writes about the threat to India from Red China via the Hindu Kush, which has always been a vulnerable region, via Tibet. And he wrote it then, almost 13 years before the actual invasion. He speaks about the Hindu-Muslim problems and even about the Pakistan split, Akhand Bharat, everything is foreseen. So it's just that, unfortunately, now interest is coming up, but many people, he has been, unfortunately sidelined by many. And for various reasons, that's different. With Sri Aurobindo, it's like everybody wants to take interest because something they find. Even the communists take interest, the materialists take interest, the traditional spiritual people take interest. But the totality of Sri Aurobindo is too vast and all comprehending. That's where the problem comes. So people take bites, but they don't go into the depths. Yeah.
And even in the ashram, they never gave up the idea of Akhand Bharat.
Yeah. It's there on the spiritual map of, and when mother was asked that, it's the map of Akhand Bharat. Yeah, she uses the word the spiritual map of United India. And she was asked that, was it made before the partition? She said, no, it was made after the partition. It's the truth of India. And naturally being in the ashram means it's a force which will realize itself. So these are fundamental truth. As I said, Pakistan is an artificial nation. Artificial nations cannot survive. Nature will do something to throw it away. It's just not possible. So it's an artificial construct. And that's why it will go, even logically it will go. Because if you look at the history of nations, artificially created nations can't survive. They have to find some way.
Sir, Rajendra Namdar here.
Please.
So, where do you see India, Bharat and Sanatana Dharma in the next 25 years?
I understand. So where do I see India 25 years? Now first I'll make a statement and then justify and qualify it. So I see India as the not just one of the leading forces, but the leading force in world. So now there are two reasons to start with, which are occult and spiritual. In 1909, Sri Aurobindo was asked about it. And Sri Aurobindo said first that among the revolutions, he saw a lot of upheaval and India will become free. And then he writes a little later in 30s that the sun of India's destiny will rise and overflow India and overflow Asia and overflow the world. And he saw the rise of Asia, incidentally. He saw, he didn't use so many words, but he saw the downfall of Europe. And this, if you look at it, because the cycle is moving. But Sri Aurobindo has spoken about it. And for me, that's more than sufficient. The mother once said that don't worry about India because Sri Aurobindo has taken charge of India's destiny. Now, again, not because he's an Indian. Okay, well, he is an Indian, that's a matter of great pride for us. But because India is needed for the good of the world. So second reason is that if India doesn't survive, that means God has planned that now there is going to be, the world will not survive. Because there is no idea which can save the world. Just imagine without Sanatana Dharma, what is going to happen? I mean, just a scenario. So this is the second reason that, well, I do believe that God's will is that the world will survive, whether human beings in large scale as a civilization, what will happen. But world, the earth will definitely be saved, it will survive and it will evolve to something higher, which is what Sri Aurobindo has seen. Now then I have a geopolitically, if I look at it, then I see that the shift of power starts, there is a cycle. And if you see history, the cycle shifts, the previous age of enlightenment, as it was called, before enlightenment, almost Socrates and down below. I mean, that time many civilizations were thriving, even in India. But the hub of what is called as the age of rational enlightenment, let me qualify it, because I don't like to use the word age of enlightenment without qualifying it. But we see France was the peak, before which there was Greece. So in Europe, we see that lot was happening in Europe. And that's the place where the mother is born. Now we see she comes to India, it's a shift of Shakti. And in 2014, we just celebrated or observed 100 years of mothers coming to India. First time she came in 1914 and finally in 1920. And we can actually see, because these events repeat in a cyclic manner. And because of the cyclic nature of time which we have in our Indian conception, now we see the geopolitical shift taking place all the way from Europe. It's going to America and coming towards America is an extension, if you want to call it, certain ideas of Europe. It's coming once back again to Asia. So this is the age of Asia, and in that India has to play a key role. So even if I look at it purely from a geopolitical perspective without the occult and spiritual dimension, I'll see that. And then there are certain ideas which have recently been released. Again, once again, I'm not talking of any party politics or a individual or other individuals, but it is a fact that India took a certain stance of helping out certain nations, reaching out to certain nations in their crisis, which included a nation like Turkey, which included a nation, a country like Nepal, which were very clearly having an anti-India stance. And yet during the flood, during the earthquakes, India reached out to all these nations. And during the COVID reason, and that's a very good karma that India did. Knowingly, unknowingly, I do believe that the spirit of India, that, it has done good, and this good is going to come back. It's coming back. It's coming back through the process of reverse brain drain. If I go back into the brain drain history, that was a very, very clever move with lot of cunning. It was done. Why? Well, that's a long subject altogether, why the brain drain started. But now you see what is happening. It's a reverse brain drain which is going to happen. Simply because, world situation is moving in that direction. So, yes, it's a great opportunity right now, and India shouldn't lose it. And I'm sure it won't lose it, because from what I see, from what we see of even the present political establishment, once again, it's not about a party or a certain party, but when divine wants to do his work, he will use the instruments, prepare them. He would be preparing for a long time. And because it is God who is raising the country, I would say in Shurbindo's vein, therefore its future is secured. And it doesn't matter. We think it's a person. No, that person himself has been placed by the divine. And he will ensure that the right people come at the right time and the right thought, the right ideas. But we have to participate in this yajna. We each have our own role to play. And we should participate in this new Ashwamedhi yajna.
Yeah, thank you, sir. So this radicalism that we see and this changing demographics, etc., is, I think, a passing phase then.
Yeah, this is a passing phase. See, I have a very funny answer to this. Now, on one side, this radicalism is the one which has awakened the world to the menace, it's like saying that whether it's good to have a snake in your room, which you don't see, and to see it, and then you try to, confront it where it's hiding. So I always believe seeing it is better, because, the menace was hiding. It was hiding everywhere. It was hiding in madrasas. It was hiding in all this was going on. So we have seen the snake. Now, the moment you see the snake, then the solutions have to come. One thing we have to be careful, the solution will not come if we in toto, in a blanket way, start saying all Muslims are bad. This is dangerous. We have to be very careful, because that's a very risky proposition. So we have to learn how to integrate, to weed off. It's like a surgery. A surgeon doesn't remove the whole everything because one part is cancerous. And at the same time, we have to work upon the ideology, because it's the ideology, and people have to talk about it openly, that, well, it's not about Muslims, it's the book, and it's, again, not about or against Muhammad. That's okay, let him be in peace. But the ideology as it has been understood today. So I keep on challenging all my friends. I say, look here, let's not talk about Muhammad ji. He is fine. He is a yogi. I concede that. Let's not talk about the first 100, 200 years of Islam. But let's talk about what ultimately it has become. That's my on ground reality. And on ground reality, the Islam of today is most dangerous menace to the world. And, you know, one should talk about it. But when you do it with this little finish, it's very different from taking a counter Kattarwadi stand, because it will create reactions. So we should be careful. So this is the other part. And the number of people, as I said, it was required to awaken. Like Europe is now waking up to the menace. It never understood the problem. Now it is understanding the problem. Now even in Arabia, the Arabs are saying, they are saying, you people don't understand what these radicals are. Saudi Arabia, one of them in the, you know, he is saying that you people, if you try to mollycoddle them, they are not going to listen. You have a uniform code. So now these are the ideas which are coming up in the world play. And lastly, but not the least, it is nature's sign. If you try to reproduce many, many, many children, your basic potency will start going down. And I give the example of, you want many rabbits or you want one lion. So India has always believed in having one lion. You see, we have those that, you know, Sikh was described that one is equal to luck barabar, or same thing was about Hindus. Say, look at one Arjun fighting against the entire army of Gandharvas when, you know, Karna is besieged. Now that's an image that there are hundreds and thousands of them clambering over Karna's chariot, and eventually Arjun intervenes, and this man alone is good enough. So we have to create quality. So quantity, whenever you go for mass production, whether it be the Chinese industry or whether it be the effort to create demographic imbalances, it won't work out. It is going to very badly backfire, because you will start becoming, and one can see that the quality of an average person is thinking is reducing so much that, you know, at least at one point of time, even among the Mohammedans, they produce some good shero shairi, ghazals, and some good thought. It's going down, because that's what happens. So one should not breed like rabbits and cats. So that's what I feel. It's a passing phase. And most importantly, the divine will is all powerful. It will find its ways and means. Yeah.
Sir, there's one last question.
Yes, please.
There was a prophecy 500 years ago by a Indonesian minister who said that he will come back and, you know, Sanatana Dharma.
Yes.
So is that happening true? That is what we are seeing now?
Yeah. It's quite likely. See, that's what Indonesia will be, one of those places where the experiment of reconversion or going back to the roots will show itself. It is bound to show itself, because they didn't disconnect. That's why I was saying it's important to introduce Ramayana, Mahabharata and the Gita not as religious scriptures. People may want to read, not read, doesn't matter. This is the government which can do it. But do it as cultural text. And what is wrong with it? Well, I need to know about my culture. I can't help it if my history is Ramayana. So it's my itihas and I need to know it. So because they have always remained connected, so I am certain that it is one of the countries, and the sign has come just yesterday or day before, that he is the man who spoke so openly, and it was so beautiful to say he advocates Israel as a nation. He says, you have to understand that, you know, people have a right to exist. They need a land. You can't just, you know. So there are this change coming in the king and coming in the princes is a sign that, you know, it will act as a catalyst. I do believe that prophecy. I have heard about it 500 years back. It was almost like a curse and then a prophecy which that the land will once again become Sanatan. Yes, very much. I would make another prophecy that even Saudi Arabia will become Sanatan. Just wait.
Oh, okay. So the idol worship of goddesses has started there.
Yes. It will become Sanatan. See, what will happen is that people are beginning to understand some places deep inside the great limitations of their beliefs. And to that extent, yes, the age of rational enlightenment did help mankind in that sense, that, well, certain democratic ideals and all these things, they are not final truths, but they are truths on the way. So definitely there are people who are beginning to, I mean, wow, who could have imagined Krishna temple or Swami Narayan temple in Abu Dhabi? I have been there, but it was unimaginable. So things are happening and probably the world is undergoing massive changes. We'll see more and more, ready for exciting time. But these changes will start from the lowest layer. The spiritual aspiration, the psychological shift, which will go unnoticed. And then it will suddenly precipitate. Then people say, ye kya ho gaya? Why this happened? But that's because of the shifting inside.
Alokya, we have to be aware of this, that some of us want to romanticize about the ancient past and want to bring it back.
So it's very important to understand that when we talk about spirituality, especially in India, so there is a core which is like the soul. And the soul has a mind-body complex which is an instrument to express it. Now we believe in rebirth. So soul takes a new form. Now when it takes a new form, it takes a new personality. Because it has evolved. Now the soul, let's say now I'm not debating into animal soul, whether it exists or not, but the soul in a primitive humanity would express itself probably, you know, by worshipping thunder as God. But the soul as a little more evolved humanity will see the gods within and still evolved, it will see as a, you know, the force of the one divine which is manifesting itself. So as we evolve, so we have to be clear that the spirit should be intact. But forms have to change. We can't go back to, you know, Manu and Raghunandan and, you know, Parashar. Though they are national icons, I'm not saying that one should, they have their place, like everything has its place. But we can't once again go back to that, because if we do that, then we'll start turning the clock of time backward. We have to go further. We have to, you know, like Walt Whitman says, you know, oh young people, go beyond us. So that's how probably Bhishma and all these people are alive. They would say, oh young, the young children of Sanatan, Santan, go beyond us. That's what I feel we should do. And it should be in every field. So the spirit should be intact. The spirit is of India, that eternal, immortal, Sanatan Dharma and all that it contains. But it should come up with new forms. Because old forms, time spirit has broken. One of them is the caste system, for example. I mean, it was necessary at a point of time, but it was broken because it became based on birth. So, Dharma Siglani, that's what is Dharma Siglani. And though Shri Krishna had established, he speaks about the Chaturvarna, but later on it has to be broken. It's broken now, so we can't go back to practicing the old method of, but we have to understand that humanity has a hierarchical progression. We have to understand it in the context of evolution. So who should be the thought leader? So that is the way it will come, it will manifest itself. The forms have to change. Yeah.
So thanks a lot, Aloji. It's almost time, 6:30, like you said.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot for agreeing to this interaction, because you know you remain busy normally.
It's a joy always with Sri Aurobindo's name. Yeah. Thank you. And India, both dear to our heart. Yes. Yeah.
So namaste. So
namaste. Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. Jai Ma.